Welcome to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy with Brent Lee and Neil Sanders. This is the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. On the 22nd of May, 2017, Salman Abedi detonated a bomb in the foyer of the Manchester Arena at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing 22 people and injuring hundreds more. A conspiracy theory claiming that this bombing was hoaxed and everyone involved was a crisis actor soon became a dominant narrative in the conspirasphere. One of the main proponents of this theory is Richard D. Hall. Over the course of this series, we will be examining the claims made by Richard D. Hall, as told in his book and documentary, Night of the Bang. Please be aware, this series will be examining a deadly bombing, and we will be discussing details of death and injury. Listener discretion is advised. This is part 7.
Right, so you remember Martin Hibbert? Martin Hibbert, the gentleman that was, he's in a wheelchair. Richard shows the picture of his, if you remember, he shows the, he says that he's probably got a herniated disc and he shows the scar on his spine.
Yep.
The problem with that, I mean, we've already talked about, so what, he got injured, kept it quiet from everybody, and then sort of like, how would that be possible? The other thing is the scar isn't in the place where you would have a scar from a herniated disc operation.
Okay.
A herniated disc operation, the scar would be directly over the spine. This is off to the side, which is, miraculously, exactly where the bolts were shown on the x-ray. Now, you can remember that he said that the black mark around the edge of the bolts shows that that it's photoshopped. But a radiologist used to live next door to my mum, so I chatted to him. I said, what does this show? And you remember he compared it to a ring that somebody had swallowed. And he says there's no blackness around the ring. The reason that there's black around the bolts is because there's air around the bolts. And what does the air show? That they've punctured the flesh. There's no air around the ring because it's swallowed and it's in the stomach. So what Richard actually thinks is showing that this is photoshopped is actually showing that it's real.
If I can give you a bit of a heads up, a way to find this out is r/radiology on Reddit, which is a subreddit that I am subscribed to for reasons I still don't understand. And I look at all these x-rays and CAT scans and MRIs I don't understand, and they explain them to me in terms I still don't understand, and I still somehow participate in this, and I don't know why. But what I can say is if you gave that to them, they would give you an explanation as to what that thing meant
straight away,
because they know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like when you said, like, you know, the air around it, because I've seen all these random x-rays and CTs and things like that, I was like, yeah, air around, yeah, okay, yeah, puncture, like it makes sense.
Yeah,
because for some bizarre reason I look at these things on Reddit. I don't know why, but I am a subscriber to several radiology subreddits. And I don't know why.
You know how both UK Critical Thinker and Richard couldn't find any pictures of Martin Hibbert not sitting or in a wheelchair? And so they assumed basically that this had happened a lot longer. You know that Richard even went to the trouble of finding out where his daughter lives and actually going to his house. You know what he didn't go to the trouble of doing? Scrolling down his Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he'd have scrolled down his Facebook page to February 2017, you'd see Martin Hibbert stood shaking hands with professional footballer Eric Cantona. So we're supposed to believe that between February and May, he lost the use of his legs and was coerced into becoming part of this plot. This is a bit confusing. When he says about the 90 miles per hour, he was told that the bullet must have hit him at 90 miles per hour. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. I know that shrapnel could actually go up to 3,000 miles per hour. So I suspect there's been some sort of breakdown in communication there. But again, it's not indicative of anybody lying, is it? And then when Richard can't figure out why he would want to keep Eve out of the public eye, you do see the crushing irony of that. Probably to stop 50-year-old men in vans turning up outside her house, fucking filming from across the street.
Exactly.
And the this is the thing, the blindness of Richard not understanding that he probably wants to keep his daughter out of the public eye so that creepy blokes in vans don't turn up and try and film her against her will. And then he does that himself. But again, he's too close to it. Now, when Genevieve Lewis basically scoffs and says, this is ridiculous, why are they writing a paper on Eve, who's got brain damage from a bolt going through her brain? Don't we already know how the brain works? It's like, can you believe? No. Eve Hibbert was the first person ever to survive an injury like that, ever. A bolt went straight through her from one temple to another temple. Now, she's making actually a miraculous recovery. Recently, a photo of her did come out. And according to Martin, I think she's going to have problems for the rest of her life, but she's doing much, much better than people.
But she's surviving okay, which is fucking great.
Well, she's surviving, yeah. So like, which is better than a lot of people expected. So that's just ridiculous. When she's saying things like, well, when he's describing the event, he does talk quite slowly and quite considered. He's like, he's remembering the incident where his daughter was brain damaged and he was paralyzed. It was a daddy-daughter day out. He's probably got loads of conflicting things. If I'd have stood a second to the right, then maybe I'd have died and she'd have survived. If I hadn't have took her, if we'd have stopped to look at that T-shirt, if we'd have stayed anything, do you know what I mean? It's a horrific event.
Yeah, I totally. Look, you know, it's ridiculous. I talked to Brett recently on an episode we did recently about 7-7. Where I was almost in there, and the idea of being sort of almost in there, I wasn't even like close to it. But at the same time, terrifying. You have these things of being like near death, and the idea of being near with a loved one is insane. Yeah. I wasn't even near that. People don't get what it is like to be near trauma.
Yeah.
They just don't get it, and they just like love to talk about it.
This is a normal reaction to traumatic experiences. Like as you say, like people react in different ways because it's not something that you're used to. So the next part is basically where he goes and films the people and puts all the hidden cameras and stuff like that. And they doubt that an 8-year-old would want to go to an Ariana Grande concert and accuse the parents of murdering him. Now, just so people know, the reason they actually moved out of their chip shop was because Lisa Russos was disabled by the bomb and she needed to like care. So she wasn't able to help around running the chip shop. So they weren't able to run the chip shop. But doesn't that somewhat fly in the face of this concept that basically they're all paid?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Like, other people, Ruth Morrell, the woman that got the bolt through her thing, she's had to crowdfund to get surgery. Like, okay, nobody's made money off the back of this. Most people have come out of it, they've done seriously badly. Now, either they're brilliant at hiding their money, right, okay. But remember, Richard made a big deal about these are all sort of low-income families, sometimes with, like, criminal records so that we can blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it's so desperate.
Why didn't Chris Parker spill the beans when they sent him to prison twice? Like, why would you overcomplicate it with these things, right, okay? It's nonsense. The idea is ridiculous as well because, like, it doesn't work like that. A detective doesn't turn up at your house and go, dead daughter, well, that's a manslaughter charge. Unless, of course, you want to be involved in this. There has a thing called trials and stuff like that.
Yes, oh, I'm studying it right now. Yeah.
Precisely. So how on earth would they've done that? Also, it's not fucking cool to accuse parents of murdering their own children or causing their death through negligence. That's not
all. No, that's not cool. And that might well be the case of a upcoming legal trial, I believe.
No, they've not sued him. It was that was what shocked me when I rewatched the film because he was
really.
It's Martin Hibbert and the lady who lost a finger who he filmed at her place of work.
I thought they were suing this motherfucker.
No, those people aren't. The Russos aren't. The Hibberts are, but not the one he accused of allowing their daughter, their toddler, to die. The only other thing is that basically Lisa Russos and her husband did say on several things that she was in a coma for 6 weeks. And she wasn't in a coma for 6 weeks. She was in a coma for 2.5 weeks, okay? So what? I'm really not fussed by that. That, to me, does not indicate, everything's a fraud then, isn't it? It's all bollocks. Like, you know, like, again, you're talking about an incident where their young daughter died. She was in a coma and their eldest daughter lost a finger, right? Okay, this is probably something you'd be forgiven for getting things mixed up in your head, basically. Right. So let's have a look at his explanation of all the people that supposedly died or that he thinks supposedly died. Right. Okay. Now, Philip Tran and Courtney Boyle, right? Now, Courtney Boyle, she's 19, and he thinks that she's abroad doing criminal psychology in the USA. And he says that there's no evidence to back this up at all. Nothing. He's not, you know, it's pure speculation. Now, he says that Philip Tran has no ties, which is absolutely true, apart from both parents, his twin sister, his daughter Olivia, three other siblings, and a partner. So apart from those people and all his friends and work colleagues and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, you remember there was a bit of discrepancy about who picked him up? Well, can you believe that if you just bothered to look at it, like basically, yeah, it was misreported in lots of newspapers, but there is a definitive story. Deborah picked up Nicole from University at Leeds. Philip, Courtney, Deborah, Nicole, and June went in his brother Martin's transit van to Manchester. They spent the day shopping there, then they dropped Nicole off at 6. They went to collect her at 10:30, whilst June and Debbie stayed in the car. Remember, she said she felt it being lifted. Courtney was 4 metres away from the bomb, as was Philip, and both of them died. CCTV footage from the event shows her lying on the floor and Robert Crewe, a member of the public, checking her vital signs and noticing that she's dead and putting a white poster over her face. Paramedic Patrick Ennis confirmed she was dead. Philip is seen lying down on CCTV at 10:30. TSO worker Philip Clegg catches Philip's body on his body cam at 22:36. He appears dead, and then PC Jessica Bullock covers his face with a T-shirt, and Patrick Ennis confirms that he's dead. Now, this is going to be a running theme because this is what the inquiry did. Now, again, I agree with Richard. We did not see the images, and there was a certain degree of trust me, bro. But did you see how detailed that one was? That's a really short one. Marcin and Angela Cliss. I mean, we can see him in the John Boar footage. We can actually see his dead body there. He's wearing a red shirt, and you can see his bald head. They had two daughters, one who's 20 and one who's 12. We're supposed to believe that they fucked off to Poland, leaving the 12-year-old daughter under the care of a 20-year-old. Why would either of them agree to that? Like, it's just nothing, basically. And when Genevieve Lewis says, this is the one, we were evacuated. This is Alex Cliss, who's 20. We were evacuated to a hotel, and one of my mum's friends picked me up from Manchester and took us home. Wrong pronoun equals lying. No, it equals that you live in Manchester.
Yep.
She picked us up and took us home. Also, she's talking about more than one person.
So it's even the right pronoun.
So it just fails on every single level.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he right about anything? Is he right about anything at all at this point?
No, nothing thus far. Other than the fact that there is a connection between MI5 and the Albaidis, and that they didn't actually show the CCTV footage at the inquiry. They showed some of it, not all of it. But
there's a reason for that.
Yeah. And if you go over what they explain in the inquiry, it's really detailed. Marcin Cliss and Angela Cliss arrived at the arena at 6:30 p.m. They wandered around Manchester and took a selfie. CCTV shows the pair holding each other's hands just before the bomb went off. And they're seen
you're making me sad.
In the bar cottage, on CCTV at 10:32, on Philip Clegg's body-worn camera, member of the public Sarah Burke tried to help Angela, but she was dead, right? Sergeant John Whittaker looks over Marcin at 10:38. Patrick Ennis identifies them as deceased. 10:45, arena medic Ken O'Connor covers Angelica's face with a T-shirt taken from the merchandise stand. And at the same time, CCTV shows PC Bullock near the bodies. At 10:50, PC Stephen Cook leans over Marcin's body and covers his face with a poster. The level of detail.
Just so real.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, so I'm not going to do that for all of these because it's more of the same.
It's exhausting and it's tiring and it's sad. So much that it really is one of those things. As an Australian who just sort of saw this as a news story, I've found the last couple hours a real wake up call to just an absolute tragedy, to the loss of life that really sort of flew past me, and it just fucking sucks. And the fact that these motherfuckers are trying to exploit it is awful. But man, I'm pouring it out. I'm pouring it out for these guys, man. They are, man, this is bullshit.
It's horrible. Liam Curry, now I pointed this out when I said it, Liam Curry and Chloe Rutherford, apparently they've got absolutely no ties, but then later their large extended families both took a holiday together in Australia. You can see the immediate contradiction. These people who've got no ties except for their parents and cousins and brothers and sisters. It's like, again, it just doesn't hang together. Right. Paul Price and Eileen McIver, he says that he felt that their relationship was fake because basically the photograph wasn't real. He says it was photoshopped. You know, if you'd have just Googled it or gone on their Facebook page, I found six others of them together, right? It wasn't difficult. So the idea that this was a fake relationship is just absolutely nonsense. Paul's children, Miles and Gabrielle, I've watched an interview with them. They were devastated by the loss of this woman who they considered a mother. She'd been like her guardian for 13 years.
That's why she was there, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, precisely. Again, there's a long and detailed explanation of what happened, what was caught on CCTV. Again, I haven't actually seen the CCTV footage, but there are so many people involved and so many timestamps. I realize, okay, that it would be grim to just go through all of this. So does that seem fair if I just basically say, just trust me on this one, right? Okay. They're seen on CCTV at least 9 times by various different people. So and not on just on one camera, on various different cameras.
Absolutely. And the rest of this, you can go and look at yourself. You don't have to listen to us at all. You can go and look at the inquest yourself.
Yeah, if you go to the inquiry and then go to the actual court document on for every single person that died, there is a massively detailed list, minute by minute, of where they were, who they interacted with, what happened, what injuries they sustained. You can find their autopsies, or not their autopsies, but you can find the results of their autopsies. There is more evidence to suggest that it happened than suggest that it didn't happen. Is Richard right? Do they prevent you from seeing this? Yes, they do. But it is so detailed and there are so many people involved that it just doesn't make any sense otherwise. Right, okay, again, Alison Howe and Lisa Lees, he thinks that they've run off to Florida because they've got a picture of Dolphin Cove on their Facebook. Brent pointed this out. That's like having a picture of fucking Disneyland on your Facebook. Do you know how many people have been to Dolphin Cove? That is in no way indicative that these people didn't die.
Because it's an attraction at SeaWorld.
Yeah, it's the dolphin. You swim with dolphins there. Like thousands and thousands. I think there's something like 10,000 people go there every month.
Yeah.
So Alison, who's got no ties, left behind her husband, Stephen, her daughters, Sasha and Darcy, and also her stepsons, Lewis, Jack, Jordan and Harris. She's got no ties from them. Lisa, who's got no ties, left behind her husband, Anthony, her daughters, India and Lauren, her grandson, Jaden, and at the time, Lauren was pregnant with Dylan Jack, who was going to be her second grandson. And again, there's a very, very, very detailed and long explanation of all the people that were, all the times they were caught on CCTV and all the people that interacted with them before they were pronounced dead. Again, it's ridiculous. Michelle Kiss, who was the person that died with Ruth Morrell, who Genevieve Lewis claims that they weren't friends at all, she's apparently got no ties other than her husband and 3 kids and a sister that she describes as her best friend in the entire world.
Fucking hell, man.
Isn't it stupid at this point?
Like, it's so hard to get past that.
Isn't it? Because it doesn't even hold water. If she'd lived alone and got no friends, he'd say, all right, maybe. But he's not even fulfilling his own criteria. Wendy Fall, age 50, apparently she's sodded off somewhere. He doesn't know exactly where she is, but he's put her down again.
Oh, good.
He's put her down again as a no ties. Yeah. She's got a 15-year-old daughter cool. and a son in his early 20s.
No ties.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, it was the daughter that went to the concert with her. She went there to pick up her daughter, who was 15 at the time. So again, this concept that they've got no ties is ridiculous. And then basically saying that Caroline, who's the friend who survived, is lying by saying, oh, we weren't, you know, there was quite a lot of people around. We weren't expecting so many people. And she said, oh, I'll go that way, you go that way, and then we won't miss him. It should be them. Pronouns are wrong. Again, I don't hold any weight to that at all. She was seen on CCTV, on body-worn camera and various other cameras over 11 times. About 14 different people interacted with her while she was dying. And if people want to look at that minutia, I'll show you the link. Safi Roussos, who's the little girl that was 8, they think that she died at home, and there's absolutely no evidence to support this. It's just pure speculation. And also, they ran out of money due to caring for Lisa, which is why they left their chip shop. Again, it's just pure speculation, and it's nonsense. Now, Paul Reed, who sat with Safi Roussos while she was dying for 31 minutes, in an interview, he says, it was a bit like a movie, almost like I wasn't there. And she says, oh, that's a confession, that is. And it's like, it's not. God. That's how everyone describes things. He says, he changes his language from this big geezer to this man when describing putting a tourniquet on this bloke. He says, initially he says, oh, this big geezer fell down. So anyway, I got this man and tied a tourniquet on it. And she says the change of description is indicative of lying, which is just nonsense. I'm going to do this one. Safi, Lisa and Ashley arrive at Manchester Arena at 18:35. CCTV shows they enter the city room at 10:30. At 10:31, Safi is on the ground next to her mom. 22:33, she tries to get up but can't. Member of the public, Paul Reed, arrives and sits next to Safi at 22:35 and stayed with her for 31 minutes. At 22:37, Jacqueline Day, merch manager, sits next to Safi and tries to comfort her. Two of the paramedics are shown standing with Safi on Philip Clegg's body-worn camera. At 22:40, UK medical staff Marion Gibson goes to help Safi, and they cut her leggings off and see that her legs are full of shrapnel. 22:41, second medic Liz Woodcock tries to help, as does third medic Ken O'Connor. 22:44, British Transport Police Sergeant Dale Edwards looks over Safi. 22:46, ShowSec staff Amy Barrett also tries to help Safi. 22:50, British Transport Police Sergeant Peter Wilcock directs off-duty nurse Bethany Crook to try and help Safi. Ambulance arrives at 23:07. DC Mark Havilord, PC Liam McLaughlin, they make a stretcher for Safi out of advertising boards and take her to hospital where she later dies. The level of detail and the amount of people, aside from the fact that that is horrific. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's more evidence that suggests it was a real event than there's no evidence that suggests that it was nonsense. Yeah. Sorrow Lukowski, who was 14 when she died. Apparently she's in New York. And it's like, again, there's just no evidence of this. There's just absolutely no evidence. And she's the one that basically, they've got friends in North Carolina. And apparently people are watching the house to see if she turns up. Again, he's lost the plot with this. He's too close to it. Jane Tweddle died going to collect her friend Joe Aaron's daughter. And if you remember, her partner was military, which is apparently suspicious. Apparently she's moved to Australia where her daughter lives because she's got no ties. I mean, other than the daughter in Australia, oh, and her partner Mark, and both parents who are still alive, oh, and two daughters that live in Blackpool and a brother Paul. But apart from all of those, she's got no ties. Kelly Brewster also has no ties, and she's gone to Dolphin Cove in Florida. No ties apart from both of her parents, her sister, two nieces, her partner, Ian, and his daughter, who she considers her own, and her brother, Adam, who she was incredibly close to. No ties at all. Nell Jones, the thing that was very, very suspicious about that was she was described as saying, on crutches and yet leaky arms, which is apparently impossible. It's like, it's not though, is it? You just put your arm around your arm in the crutch.
Yeah, that's, I've done that.
Yeah, basically like, oh, that was the thing, like, her long hair was all burnt, and Genevieve Lewis thinks this is a lie because we use the shortest amount of words ever. We really don't. We just don't. That's just utter shite, that is, basically. Like, when she says, they gave us bandages and we round them around her arm to keep the blood because her blood was just oozing. It should be me or I. It's not us, again, because they're northern. They're speaking in a northern accent.
Yeah.
Like, now, here we go. This is a bit that I saw people get angry about this in the Crest thing, when she says that memory due to experience is easy to recall in chronological order because of the experience. A subject can recite the date backwards and forwards due to the trauma of a bomb blast. A person's adrenaline would be on high alert and their senses sharpened and heightened, recalling in vivid detail everything that's happened. Going out of chronological order indicates deception. That's absolute bollocks. Right. Okay. Now, there's a degree of truth to it because traumatic memory can be extremely vivid and it can be quite accurate due to the high emotion and the cortisol hormones that go out. It can lead to what's called encoding. So sometimes it can be actually very, very true that you can remember something very, very vividly. The high quality remembering for traumatic events is not just a lab-based finding, but has been observed in real-life experience, such as among survivors of child sexual abuse and war-related atrocities. For example, researchers who studied memory accuracy in child sex abuse survivors 12 to 21 years after the event found that severity of the post-traumatic stress disorder was positively correlated with the degree of memory accuracy. Further, all persons who identified the CSA as the most traumatic event in their life displayed highly accurate memory for the event. Similarly, in a study of World War II survivors, researchers found that participants who scored higher on post-traumatic stress reactions had war memories that were more coherent, personally consequential, and more rehearsed. The researchers concluded that highly distressing events can lead to subjectively clearer memories that are highly accessible. And that's Thomas D.K. Benson, The Long-Term Impact of Emotionally Stressful Events on Memory Characterizations. And so there's a degree of truth to it. If an event elicits an emotional reaction, it's more likely to inform our memory. Things that have more emotional significance tend to get more encoded. The central details of an event get burned into their memory and they may never forget them. That's from Jim Hopper at Harvard. Richard McNally says, the stress hormones cortisol, norepinephrine, that are released during a trauma event make the event vivid and more memorable, especially the central aspect of the most meaningful aspects of the experience for the victim. And there is also things called intrusive memories. So if you've got post-traumatic stress disorder, sometimes you might just have what's similar to a flashback where you vividly remember something. In a study called Vividness and Immutability, trauma memories can be startlingly clear even many years after the event. In a dissociative flashback, the client may even lose all awareness of their present surroundings. So it sounds like Genevieve Lewis is correct. Yeah, we always remember trauma. We always remember things in chronological order. Sounds like she's correct. Except she's not, is she? However, this does not always occur. Some psychologists believe in the concept of memories being repressed to avoid reliving the trauma. Perhaps one of the most controversial and well-known of the psychological effects that trauma can have on patients is repressed memories. The theory is that an event is so traumatic that the memory was not forgotten in the traditional sense, but removed from the conscious mind. Now, since Freud proposed this, this has been heavily argued and debated, but basically, some people say that this is, you can create false memories. And this is also true. Memories can be created. There's a very famous study where people are told about meeting Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. And they all can't remember it. But when they come back for the following session, they go, you know what? I had to think about it. And I do remember meeting Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. Now, this is obviously a false memory because Bugs Bunny isn't associated with Disneyland. But that just shows that the power of suggestion can go a long way. So sounds like that she might be right, but it's not as easy as that. Like, this is complicated by the fact that
it's never as simple as that.
No, trauma can actually mess up your long-term memory. And so basically the brain is not a video recorder. So although you might be thinking that you're remembering it correct, memory is actually fluid. And without you knowing it, the subconscious is totally altering it. If everybody remembered every traumatic event, you'd never have discrepancies in witness statements, would you? One of the different aspects of memory working short-term memory, one of the most commonly affected by psychological trauma is long-term memory. Missing memories, changes to memory, or intensified memories are all cases of manipulations of long-term memory. And that's Gregor Gosselin Blanchett, 2020, The Impact of Trauma Exposure on Explicit and Implicit Memory.
The worst thing is it goes both ways, of course, which is that severe trauma can be very memorable. It also can be something that's repressed.
Yeah.
So you really don't know which way it's going to go. And that is the worst part of the fact that you can never really know where it's going to be.
Richard McNally says almost exactly the same thing in debunking myths about trauma and memory. Regardless of how photographic our memories sometimes seem, the mind does not operate like a video recorder. We can all recall an episode from our past, but we reconstruct it from elements distributed throughout the brain. Recollection is always a reconstruction. It is never a matter of reloading a videotape for the mind's eye. Memory from trauma is not exempt from this principle. The living brain is dynamic, and even the most vivid traumatic memories are not literal, unchanging reproductions of what occurred. Although certain theorists assert that manifestations of traumatic memory are invariable and do not change over time, this is completely mistaken. No memory, traumatic or otherwise, is ever frozen and immune from the vicissitudes of time. Now, further to this as well, the emotional stress means that although some might be remembered, some things might be completely forgotten because it depends on what's important to you. Everybody's seen that he pulled a gun on me. Well, what was he wearing? Oh, I don't know. I can't remember what he was wearing. or people describing people wearing wildly different things. I saw somebody throw a brick through my neighbor's window, watched it happen, made a statement about it, and et cetera, et cetera. And then 2 days later, I went, shit, was he wearing that top or was he wearing a different top? So moving on to Eileen McLeod, who's 14. You remember he thinks that she's somewhere studying music because she liked bagpipes or whatever. And the big thing was that Richard and UK Critical Thinker, they said that she didn't have a death certificate. They couldn't find their death certificate. This is because they were looking in Scotland for the death certificate. Now, you know, if you'd have just gone to Manchester County Council, you could have found the death certificate that I'm holding in my hand right now. This is Eileen McLeod's death certificate, 22nd of May, 2017, situated with the Manchester Arena at the Victoria Exchange Complex.
I just fucked up. You had to get that.
Isn't it?
Yep.
But it's available. This is the point.
Yeah.
It's real.
You should, but a book is published. A book is published about that.
Yeah.
But you have that in your hand. That is disgusting.
Isn't it? So Olivia Campbell Hardy, she's the girl that basically was with the gentleman that got the thing through his cheek. Now, Richard says that basically he doesn't even think that these people were friends. Like, he's like, you know, he thinks that it's all contrived. So I went on her Facebook page, and there's a couple of pictures of them weeks before the concert. That's it. If you remember as well, they basically thought that he was lying because he said, honestly, it's that she's that kind of person who have the best time. Honestly, they have the best, they get the best impression on you. He's a teenager talking to a reporter. Like, that's what teenagers talk about. There's the other girl where she chastises her for keep saying cause. It's like, have you ever spoken to a teenager? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But needless to say, again, Olivia Campbell caught on various CCTV devices and body-worn cameras. It's very well documented how she unfortunately died. Megan Hurley. Now, basically, they remember if you said that they couldn't really find anything out about Megan Hurley, and they found it specifically really, really confusing because she's never mentioned, not once, in the Liverpool Echo, which is the local newspaper. Oh, sorry, except for the 22nd of June, where there's a tribute to her, the 28th of June, where her funeral is reported on, the 30th of June, where her funeral is reported on, the 23rd of May, where a fundraiser is started for her, the 26th of May, where it talks about her and how her friends at school miss her, the 9th of October, where another charity organisation, August 2017, where there's a profile of her, 28th of August 2018, where there's also a profile of her, and then 21st of March 2018, where there's another tribute to her. So yeah, apart from all of those occasions.
9 times.
Yeah. And that's just the ones I found with a quick Google search.
Oh yeah, no, it sounds like you were just doing your research.
Yeah.
This was before the book was published. So again, it's just ridiculous, basically.
Just stunning.
John Atkinson, the poor soul who basically, they said, oh, this sounds like it's made up. Apparently he dragged himself across the room and then died of a heart attack. Yeah. He was injured in his legs. He was moved to the clearance zone after 50 minutes of lying there bleeding. Because he was a larger gentleman, the advertising boards weren't strong enough to carry him. So they had to go and get metal barriers and use those as stretchers. He actually had a cardiac arrest in the back of the ambulance. But then Richard speculates that his heart attack was due to his losing weight. He's like, well, hang on. I thought these people weren't dead. Is he dead or what? You're not even coherent in your own thinking.
Yeah, what's the... Yeah. All okay. Right, line it up.
But basically, Richard also thinks that John falls into the no ties category because he hasn't got a partner, except he has got a partner whose name is Michael. Michael is the brother of Gemma. Gemma is the girl that he went to the concert with. Okay. He's got three sisters. Both his parents are alive and he's an uncle. But apparently this bloke's got no ties apart from his partner, his parents, his sisters, and his nephew. But apart from that, absolutely no time.
I don't like your mate.
He's starting to get...
I'm not...
He's starting to make it more difficult to like him, isn't it?
Because the thing that I don't mind about Alex Jones is the fact that what he does is that he tries to sell supplements on the fact of, on the back of bullshit, but he also kind of skates over a lot of things. I feel like Alex Jones denies plausibility by not addressing it, whereas this guy, for better or worse... goes into detail, and I don't like that because I like the idea that you're a moron, not that you're wrong and you're awful. you know, I don't want you to be malicious. I want you to be stupid. But I don't think this guy's stupid. I think he's malicious.
I think he comes across as malicious because he's convinced that he's right.
Yeah. And no, you're right. But like, I would prefer him to be a basic idiot than someone who's thought about so many things to justify being so toxically wrong.
I'm afraid so. Like,
absolutely.
Martin Hett, we're on the home stretch now. Martin Hett, and remember he went to Stuart Aspinall's partner's house a few times and was confused that he left his seat at 10:20 and went to the foyer because why would he do that? Because he'd gone past the toilets and the drinks. Well, it's because he was phoning his friend. He was phoning his friend because he was going to meet them at the Village in Manchester before he went on his big holiday. Now, furthermore, you know how Richard said that there's no evidence that this person was at the concert? Paul, his friend, has footage of Martin dancing at the concert. It shows him dancing, and then it pans around and shows Ariana Grande on the stage. But Richard's contention is he was never there in the evening, so it's ridiculous. And there is an explanation for why he was going to the foyer, because he phoned his friends, because he was going to meet them at the Village. So again, it's just absolutely nonsense. Again, he thinks he's got no ties apart from his boyfriend, his parents, his step-parents, and his five brothers and sisters. Again, ridiculous. Last one, Georgina Colander. This is so silly. Like Richard says, because she's 18, so she's probably thinking of going to university. So she's probably an apprentice child and she's abroad at university somewhere. Doesn't say doing what, doesn't say where. That's it. That's literally it. Stupid.
Well, so that's it. That's just vanished.
That's his explanation on that one. Yeah, he's not as thorough with that one. But again, needless to say, there's lots and lots of footage and corroborating evidence that she sadly died in the arena. Loads and loads of people interacted with her. It's horrific.
And that concludes part 7. Thank you for listening to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. Tune in next week for the final part. And as always, if you subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/somedarecallitconspiracy, you can listen to the full 8-part series right now. Thanks again.